At this time, I'd like to introduce Tony M. from Atlanta, Georgia.
Hi, everybody. My name is Tony. I'm an addict.
Tony.
Wow. Just let me have a moment. Okay. I've been trying to figure out what my topic has been for, I think, 2 days or 3 days, and I had to get the paper to put it in front of me. Okay. Hurting on the inside. You know, I've been thinking about, yeah, and that's when I'm in trouble, right? I've been thinking about the past hurts and the present hurts and just the hurting, you know, and it's just so amazing how even with that, I have peace in the midst of the storm. You know, that's what recovery has given me, the ability to have peace in the midst of the storm. And see, they always say it's like we're either going into a storm, just coming out, or, you know, on the other side. And there's always going to be a storm coming. You know, you watch the weather, right? It travels from west going to the east. But you know that if you're in California and you're in Oklahoma, you're going to get what they just had. And by the time it gets to the east coast, you don't even know what it's going to be, you know. And that's how I think about my past pain to my present pain. It's like being in California in my past pain, and by the time we get to the East Coast, you know, it might be the same storm, but it looked real different by the end. You know, not saying it can be better, greater, less, or whatever. It's going to be what it's going to be. And I got to deal with it on life terms and not my own. You know, I'm going to read a couple of things from The Journey Continues. It says, my life seemed stable by outward appearances, but inside I was a mess. I was clean, but miserable, reactive and fearful. We find ourselves in these dark places sometimes with many, many years clean. Long buried emotions come pouring to the surface, and we may or may not have the tools to deal with them. A lot of times I think of my life, right, as like, you heard the story of the ugly duckling, right? And if you haven't, I'll give you a little synopsis on it, what it means to me. And in my family, I always felt like the ugly duckling. I always felt like I just didn't fit in. And in the ugly duckling story, the eggs was all together and they hatched, and then it was just one. All of them looked alike. Except one. And that one, everybody picked on and talked about, and when they was trying to waddle and get in line, that one just didn't get in line. You know, and that one just, feathers was ruffled a little different, and one just couldn't swim like every other one swam, and the one just was a different color, and the one just couldn't hang with the rest of them, and the one just felt so ugly. But when the one grew up, it turns into a swan, and it became beautiful, even with its differences. And the ducklings started to be in awe with that one, as they thought, was the ugly duckling. And that's what Narcotics Anonymous did for me, you know, because I always felt like the ugly duckling, like I just didn't fit in. I was called the misfit. I was the darkest one in my family, and I grew up thinking, and this was some hurt on the inside. You know, I grew up thinking that something was wrong with me because everybody else was light-skinned. Everybody else looked like damn near white, right? And they would go to my sister and say, oh, you know, speaking Spanish, because they thought she was Puerto Rican. And she'd be like, no, I'm black. I don't know what you're talking about, right? And they would look at me and be like, you know, my family would joke and say, you're the misfit, because I was darker. And so I really thought I was dark-skinned. So I didn't like light-skinned people. And I used to think that I was a dark-skinned person. Until I got in recovery. I'm serious. And then I realized people be like, no, you red bone, no, you yellow, you this. And I just did not want to be that, because all my life I was teased by my family of being different. They told me I was adopted. I mean, they would tell me all this stuff. So that story, the ugly duckling, I fit real right in. See, my oldest sister was the beauty queen, and everybody would talk about how beautiful she was. Then my middle sister, she was the one that was real, real fair-skinned, and I just thought she was just wonderful. And then it was me. When I was 5 years old, my mother said I was half ugly and half pretty. And I, at five, I thought that meant that I thought it was a joke, like I was, she said, you're pretty ugly. And I thought that meant I'm half pretty and half ugly. By the time I turned 11, I thought that meant, Tony, you're pretty ugly. And it took time for me to understand what that meant. I never asked her about it, but as time went on, I realized that I might have some outer beauty. I never even realized it. When I think I was 17, somebody said, you got nice eyes. Right, I have a lazy eye, and you know, it took time for to train them. They was going all which way but loose, and you know, I had a patch on my eye. I just felt like a pirate. People would call me all kind of names. And see, I was teased as a child, right? And I had bullies. By the time I was in second grade, this one chick named Mary used to chase me home and catch me at the fence every time. She was in fifth grade, so I was scared of her, right? And by the time I get to the fence, she would punch me in my stomach. I'd be like, oh my God. Then another time I'd be running fast, and then she'll catch me at the gate and she'll punch me in my stomach. And then my girlfriend, Peanut, right? This second grade, told me to meet her at this late girl's house, and I don't know why I'm like 8 years old, out at 1 o'clock in the morning. See, this is in Chicago, and my mother worked 11 to 7, so I'm the youngest. I kind of did what I wanted to do, and I met Peanut at the door, but she wasn't at the door. Who was at the door was Mary. And she punched me in my stomach. So the next time I seen Peanut, I got her upstairs. I slapped her in her face. I told her, don't you ever set me up like that again. And then I seen Mary, and we fought. And I whooped her. Mary never bothered me again. You know, and the pain within, I mean, let me tell you, the hurting within started back then as a little girl. You know, and then I started getting molested by my stepfather from the time I was 6 years old till I was 12. And it was all these things that was happening, and it was domestic violence going on in my household, and it was just so demeaning and so crazy and so chaotic. And then also neglect was going on, and we grew up in filth, right? And I just didn't have a clue, and I just was hurting, and the pain, it was like a gnawing in my gut from being raised like this. And it wasn't my fault, you know, but I took it on. Because see, when, especially with the molestation, I felt, when I found out that it was wrong, I found out it was wrong by me touching a little girl when I was 12 years old, and she pulled back. Like, what's wrong with you? And I'm thinking, well, that's what we do, you know. Then the guilt and shame set in, and then I thought that if that's wrong, that means it's wrong for him to do that. And if it's wrong for him to do that, then I need to have stopped him long time ago. And see, I didn't know that I wasn't responsible for that. That pain within, that hurting within, that hurting on the inside, and I carried that with me, you know, and I became angry. And I became resentful, and I became spiteful, and I just didn't know how to deal with those emotions. So when the first time that I used, I was an addict waiting to happen. I really was. It was like my life was set up just for that moment, and when I did, it was alcohol. Alcohol really was my second drug of choice, because my first drug of choice was fantasy. Because of all the shit that was happening to me in my life, I had to be able to escape somehow. And I escaped through books. I escaped through fantasy. I escaped through La La Land. I mean, I would cut out paper dolls and make toys of my own and do different things so I didn't have to feel in the moment of what was going on. I would just disappear when he would touch me. When my mother and father would, my stepfather would fight, I just had to go somewhere because I was the littlest one and I didn't know how. When my sister was being raped And I was 5 years old. I didn't know how to deal with that. And I thought about going out. We was all in the room with her and she fighting this dude off. And I was thinking, I can go in the kitchen and get a canned good and hit him in the head. But I was paralyzed with the rest of us, all 5 of us, sitting in a room because we couldn't go anywhere. We didn't know what to do. So I just went into La La Land. You know, and that was how I dealt with things, is through fantasy. So by the time I was 15 and I picked up my first drug, which was alcohol, really was, it was Mad Dog with 7-Up in it because it was too strong, right? And me and my two girlfriends, we were walking down the tracks in Lorain, Ohio. We moved around a lot. And we was in Lorain, Ohio, and one got sick and one was crying. And I just had this smooth feeling come over me. And what happened was, I thought that I was feeling serenity, and it was numbness. So I mistaken serenity for numbness. And I chased that until I was 28 years old. And see, alcohol was my drug of choice, then crack chose me. At the end, it was crack. 4 kids later, you know. And when that time came, I didn't know that I was living to use and using to live. I didn't know that my life had got like that. I just thought that that was the way to be and the way to deal with life on life terms, because that's what my family did. We got high. You know, period. If it got rough, we got high. We celebrated, we got high. Baby showers, we got high. At parties, we got high. Kids' parties, we got high. Whatever we did, we got high. You know, that was just the way it is. You know, I remember my mother giving me a tranquilizer because I watched my stepfather beat the crap out of her, and she was like, "It's okay, just take this." And afterwards, I was like, "Don't you ever give me that shit again." You know, because that was just too much. I like being up. I don't like that down or nothing. So it was just too much. So when cocaine came into my life, it was right what I needed. But it numbed all the pain to the point where I didn't feel any pain, even physical pain. You know, so when I came into recovery, just remember, when you come into recovery, I was 28 years old. My clean date is 12/4/88, and I've been clean ever since, right? And when I came into recovery, the drug was gone, but the pain was still there. The pain within, all I knew was how to stuff. All I knew, because my mother told me when my stepfather would try to attack me physically in any type of way or verbally, she would just say, "Just be quiet. Just don't say anything." So I would hold that in, and I remember trembling, and it was that gnawing in my gut. The pain within and the hurting within, and it was nothing that I can do. And by the time I was 28, I had destroyed some people. I had destroyed some lives. I had done some things that wasn't pretty, you know, because I had my first child when I was 16. And at that point, I thought I was grown. And so from that, my attitude was I was grown. I lived on my own since I was 17 years old, had my own place. You know, my mother moved back with my stepfather because she had left him. Because I couldn't take it anymore. Because he told me, "I hope your baby live and you die." Stuff like that. You know, he was just a rotten human being. I hate to say that, but that was the truth. So the pain was just, I said, "I can't live with him." You know, I watched her try to commit suicide over and over and over, and that pain was just too much for me. You know, so when she moved back and I was left on my own, I had to learn how to live life on life terms, and I didn't know how to do it. So I did the best I could, you know. And from that, I've lived in 43 places, had 27 different jobs through my life. You know, we live from state to state, city to city. I did the same thing once I came into recovery to my family. You know, so I was 28 years old, new in recovery, 4 kids down, trying to do this thing for a 5-month-year-old, a 3-year-old, a 9-year-old, and a 13-year-old daughter. And I didn't know how to be a mother. Drugs was gone. All I knew was how to get over, scheme, try to be slick. And it didn't change nothing, because what I was able to do is take my emotions and stick them in my back pocket and keep it moving. That's all I had to do. So once the drugs was gone, I was feeling, y'all. And I was angry. Very angry. And I didn't know I was angry. And I think I was suffering from post-traumatic stress syndrome. and didn't even know that, you know, from the lifestyle that I had came from and the things that I had seen and the feelings that I had felt. It was just so much. But I came into this program because I wanted an alibi to say, see, I ain't that bad. That's how I got into treatment. They told me at the crack house, maybe you need to go to treatment. Because my attitude was really, really bad. And so I'm thinking that's a good alibi, because he said if I disappear one more time, he was going to take the kids, even though he was using. So I went to treatment, and it saved my life. The light bulb came on. You know, that was God doing for me what I can't do for myself. I remember 3 weeks prior to that, I prayed and said, God, help me. That's how God helped me. He placed me in treatment. That was my best idea, and he sent me to y'all. When I got to you, the first meeting I went to, I found my sponsor. My sponsor said, I will sponsor you. I'm like, okay. I ain't never allowed anybody to tell me what to do, because I felt like I'm going to do what I want to do and deal with the consequences afterwards. Because I knew with life there's pain. Even with relationships, I thought we were going to fight. I never thought about, oh, I love you and if you hit me, you love me. No. I thought that if you hit me, I'm going to let you see that how it feels to be in a fight with me. I might not go win because I can't beat a man, but I can kill a woman. That was my mentality. That's how I thought. But if I fought you as a man, you're going to have some scars. I'm going to bite you, scratch you, kick you, hit you, whatever I can find. And that was what I thought would have to happen. So fighting was just a part of it. Prerequisite, we're going to fight. Found out in recovery, that's not the reality. You know, the last time any man put his hands on me, I was 28 years old, 2 weeks before I came to the program, to this day. God removed violence from my life. I'm grateful for that, because if it wasn't for him removing that from my life, I don't think I would be here. I'm serious. That domestic violence is a serious thing. You know, violence against my soul. Violence to me is when my soul is injured. If you say my skirt is ugly the wrong way, that's abuse. You know, it's about being able to not be attacked or injured and being able to be respected and loved and nurtured, because that's what I needed. I needed nurturing. I needed love, and I needed unconditional love, and I didn't need judgment because I was critical of myself. So that pain within and that hurting within, when I came in, I was a hurt person, and hurt people hurt people. So when I got here, that's all I did. All I did was what I knew. I didn't know anything different. You know, so I came in with all my ways and I hurt people, like I said. And it took some time for me to outlive my behavior. It took some time for me to outlive my attitude and my actions toward other people. Because, see, I used to think that you deserved it. Because whatever I got in life, if it was something good coming my way, I deserved that. So I took life for granted. But if you did something to me, you deserve my wrath. If you abuse me, then it opened the door for me to be abusive. And it took time for me to see that hurt people hurt people. And that I didn't have to be a hurt people no more. But that was because I made peace with my past through the step process. You know, working at first, second, and third step allowed me to get into the fact that I was powerless, I was insane, and I could not control my own life, and I needed something outside of me, which was God, and a power greater than me, to understand that this is how I can kind of give you a foundation and get you together just a little bit, Tony. You know, and when I took that moral inventory, the sponsor I had, because I've had 10 sponsors, you know, and I've had the same sponsor since 94, even though I fired her a couple of times, but that don't count. No, she's sitting over there, so I got to tell the truth, you know, about how many times I fired her. But anywho, when I worked at Fourth Step, my sponsor told me that this is the first time that she ever heard her story. She had 11 years clean, and I felt so relieved, because I remember I felt like the ugly duckling. You know, and the hurt that I felt inside, even in the rooms, I felt so alone. I just felt so different. No matter what, because I was a loner, I didn't hang with a lot of people, still don't, not real cliquish. I'm a real introverted person, believe it or not. It took me a whole year before I even would talk at a meeting, let alone speak. You know, and so when she told me that, that was a relief for me. And that was the beginning of my process to be able to let go of some of this pain. It's not easy to have pain within with experiences that happen in life. You know, as time went on, I've experienced both of my parents dying. I've experienced loss of job. I've been divorced 3 times. The hardest thing was burying my mother, you know, watching her die of cancer. That pain, it took a lot for me to even understand what was going on with me through that process. It took me 3 years to understand that I was grieving and in denial, that I didn't want to accept the reality that she had died. That was a real painful process. When she was sick, I used to go to Lorain, Ohio from Cleveland, and when I would be ready to leave, she would be like, "Oh," and that touched my heart. And she had said to me one day, "Tony, I'm so sorry for what he did to you." And I let her off the hook, because, see, I held her as a hostage for, talking about her people, I held her as a hostage for what my stepfather did. And I told her, "You may have brought him in my life, but he made the decision to do what he did. You didn't make that decision." And she said, "Thank you." And she sighed relief. You know, so that was a real painful process, but it was a very healing process, because I was able to make amends with her while she was alive. You know, it's real important. No matter how you, I had to let it go. It didn't matter. All that shit didn't matter. Before I knew she was dying, I decided to step up to the plate and start being a daughter to her. And it didn't matter all that shit that happened. You know, recently my granddaughter died. And, she was 3 days old. I watched her take her last breath. That was on February 20th of this year. And it's really weird that I didn't know that I would be the one that write the obituary, set up all the plans, do everything to help my son through the process and his wife through the process, while I was still grieving through that. Last weekend, not this Sunday, but last Sunday, I helped them pack up the room finally. It took a month before we could pack up the room and pack up the clothes and pack up everything, because they had everything for her. Her name was Kennedy. You know, the pain or the hurt within from the inside, you know, I still have the pain. And what I found out, I'm going to share this and I'm going to be done. What I found out from that whole process is that I may not get over it, but I'm going to get better with it. You know, I also, from that process, found out that I need to treat each day as it is precious. Because she lived for three days, and them 3 days, she fought to live. She fought to breathe. She fought. I even got a video of her listening to my voice, and while she was listening to my voice, she smiled. You know, and I was able to give them that video of her smiling, you know, and her eyes opening up just a little bit, because they didn't see her smile. But they could see her smile from that video. But what I found out is that by us loving on her so hard as we did, it made me know that at 54, I need to appreciate every day, and I need to make it count, and I need to make my life fulfilled and do everything that I possibly can do, because it ain't guaranteed. Life, you know, you only got today. So I need to live it and love instead of living it and focusing on the wrong thing. Focusing on the wrong thing, like who said what and who doing who and who's going on with what, and you don't like me and you don't like her and all that bullshit. So I'm working on trying to focus on the right thing. Make sure my life counts. You know, I have a husband. I have 2 kids in recovery that's living in our house. I have a mother-in-law that lives in our house. I'm in college. I'm a substance abuse counselor who has gay clients, and I love them all. And it's just, my life is real, real, real full. And I don't have time to focus on the wrong thing. I need to focus on the love that I feel, support the people that's in my life, and love on that newcomer who came up here. She got 3 days, y'all. And if you didn't get anything out of my story, listen to your own. That's the one that got you here. That's the one that's going to keep you here, and that's the one that's going to keep you clean. Thank you for allowing me to share.